This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. A number of extreme weather events have made headlines around the world this year, but what effect is climate change having in Indiana right now? We're going to talk about that a little bit later with environmental experts and learn more all about that. But first, we're talking about a new art exhibit in Columbus that opened on Saturday. We're joined by Iker Gill, co-curator of the new Middles Exhibit Columbus, and Belinda Tato, architect for Ecosistema Urbano, a design and consulting company. Thank you both for joining us this afternoon. Iker, where did the idea for the new Middles Exhibit come from?
Well, thanks for having me. This was the third edition for Exhibit Columbus and the first one to invite outside curators to think about Columbus. So it was an opportunity for Mimi Seiger, my co-curator, and I to look at Columbus but go beyond its boundaries. And we wanted to explore the center of the U.S., look at the idea of the middle as its own condition, and related to think about it about the changing demographics, technology, mobility, and climate change and all those aspects that connect them. So the way we thought about the middle is this network of relationships and multiple futures. And to give a little bit of a framework to that idea, we use the Mississippi watershed as this ecological system that connects these regions.
Wow, that's really impressive. And so why is it important to focus on Columbus for this exhibit?
Well, Columbus has an impressive history of socially minded architecture that fosters life. So it's a mid-century modernist destination. It has an incredible set of buildings that were designed by renowned architects like Ion Pace, Sarina, and SOM. And in a way, it's an archetypical middle city with buildings that address the needs of the 20th century. So now the question is, how do we think about the 21st century and how do we position places like Columbus and other middle cities to face the challenges and opportunities of the 21st century?
Well, I have to be honest, I have yet to visit Columbus, but for our listeners that are listening in from all over the state, what are you hoping people take away from this exhibit?
Well, I think this is an opportunity for people to, you know, to think about that there are multiple futures, maybe reflect on our past and envision new ways of being. Maybe also think about a plurality of futures that are more inclusive and explore how architecture and landscape can be contribute or can be useful tools to move forward. So in a way, the installations don't give all the solutions, but they provide a path that include, a plurality of narratives and approaches.
So it's kind of like maybe a blueprint for what the future could be.
Exactly. Just a different way of looking at what's ahead and, think about what is possible.
Belinda, what is Ecosistema Urbano?
Okay. Well, thank you so much for the invitation to join the conversation today. So Ecosistema Urbano is a firm that we started in the year 2000 in Spain, together with my colleague and partner, José Luis Vallejo. And we've been working around public space and climatic comfort in different parts of the world, doing all kind of a scale of designs from a very furniture-like to more kind of master planning.
Okay. And what work of yours will we see at this exhibit?
Well, we've been working in front of the Central Middle School, and it's been a privilege to have such a beautiful site. It is a beautiful green lawn that is kind of a canvas, and the idea was to produce this kind of interface between the school and the city. And I would also like to remember that we started the work for this site in the middle of the pandemic last fall. At that time, it was not so clear that the school would be open this year. So it was a very kind of interesting question of how to create this kind of publicness or togetherness space in front of a school that we didn't know if it would be open. So we created this conversation with the school community, and it was very clear to us that they miss very much the social experience that the school provides. So that's why we created this cloud room, and it's a kind of a word game with the idea of the classroom under the clouds.
And Belinda, you're mentioning that it was tricky kind of trying to do this in the middle of a pandemic. Did anything surprise you that you had to adjust to for this project?
I mean, I think it's been a kind of an interesting and intense process for all of us, because we were all, again, thinking about the future of the city and thinking about installations in the public space, whereas at the same time, we were all confined in our kind of domestic space. So somehow for me, it was very sensitive, again, to talk to these people and how much they missed the social experience that the school provides as a public space, and thinking how we could address this publicness in this lawn, which actually, it is very beautiful, but it's very very difficult to kind of use under the sun, because the sun is very tough. So this idea of kind of providing the conditions for kids to come back to the school somehow, regardless of the conditions of the 2020-2021 school opening or not.
Oh, that's interesting. And Iker, what will people see at the exhibit along with Belinda's projects?
Well, we have 13 installations plus the work of two photography fellows. So the topics are quite diverse. Some of them explore the relationship between places named after Christopher Columbus, mapping through a series of polls those connections. We have, as Belinda explained, like new modes of learning. Some of the projects raise awareness of environmental challenges. Some of the other ones, they create public spaces for second and third shift workers. So thinking about the invisible workers and how do we create public spaces for them. Others look at archives and recontextualize archives and position them in today's conversation. They create new narratives around the idea of utopia and kind of like merge them with roadside signs and Americana. They visualize the relationship between infrastructures that control the Mississippi and the communities that live nearby, and they do that through models and also photography. We have projects like Joyce Wan who amplify habitats for urban wildlife and how do we live as humans with urban wildlife in the same space, advocate for inclusion and think about aerial activities. So in a way, a lot of these projects also make visible some of the conditions that shape our built environment, but that they are invisible.
If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're talking with Iker Gill, co-curator of the New Middles Exhibit Columbus, and Belinda Tato, architect for Ecosistema Urbano, a design and consulting company. Belinda, how important is it to use art to draw attention to various issues?
Well, I think it's exciting to kind of, ask questions about ourselves, about our past, our present, and of course about our future. And I think Exhibit Columbus creates the framework to do that. And actually, the city of Columbus is the perfect site to do that, because as Iker was mentioning, it's a very special city with an amazing architecture legacy, but also it's a very special community. And I was very surprised and delighted, actually, to meet many of the people in the community. They're very aware about, art, design, and architecture, and the values that are kind of embedded into that. But also, they're very eager to discover and to have new experiences. And I really think that this kind of festival or show that happens every second year, it's an amazing opportunity to rediscover the spaces in a different way, to have a completely fresh look at them. And I was delighted to see the other installations, which are kind of, I knew some of this work, but I didn't know all of them. So I'm happy and sure that the Columbus kind of community, they're going to be appreciating it more over the next coming weeks.
And Iker, sort of the same question for you. How important is it for art to connect people to what's going on in the world?
Well, I think it's critical. I mean, I think it gives an insight and visualizes maybe the opportunity of how do we think about our future? How do we want to build as a community? It gives a presence, and as I said before, maybe it visualizes some of those conditions that are out there that are hard to grapple. And this is a way for everybody to engage with them. I think the installations that are in Columbus, they're also great spaces to experience if you don't know a lot of the background of the work. So it's a great entry point into these conversations, and then that people can take farther.
Mm-hmm. And Belinda, when it comes to the architecture in Columbus, you mentioned, this is a unique city and the architecture is interesting. What is it that's so interesting about it if you compare it to other places you've been?
I mean, I think there is a care of public space, and there is this idea of, in some other places, architecture is very good or has a very good kind of quality, but actually the space in between that architecture is not so exciting. And I would say that, walking through Columbus has always been very, very interesting in terms of landscape design, in terms of materiality, in terms of care. So I really appreciated not only, again, the architecture pieces, but also kind of the in-between space them. Which really kind of is kind of the perfect setting for the lifestyle and the life quality of the people. So because we do spend a lot of time indoors inside the architecture pieces, but we also definitely spend a lot of time in between spaces. And I really appreciated that.
And Iker, the exhibit's already open. What have you heard so far from people who've been able to attend?
Yeah, the exhibition opened last weekend, and it was a great celebration. Having worked for so many months individually, all from home, like being able to gather there, see how everybody began to experience the places. Everybody responded very well. It was great to see people who had seen the previous two editions and see the third one, the new conversations that we're providing, how the different teams were exploring the topics. They were very excited about it, and I'm just very excited to see how it evolves in the next 3 months. We have kind of more programs organized in October, so it's going to be great to see how people enjoy daily activities in Columbus, but with a new perspective, and how they respond to those spaces.
And Belinda, what have you heard so far from folks who've come to the exhibit?
Well, I had the opportunity to be, in the installation and over the weekend, and there was people coming by, and it was so nice. We engaged in so many interesting conversations that we wouldn't have otherwise if there wasn't public space. So I really, for me, the kind of the main thought is like, all these installations will trigger some relationships and some conversations that otherwise wouldn't happen. And I think that is the fascination of public space and art, because you really kind of connect to people that otherwise you wouldn't connect to, because you just don't have an opportunity to do so. So I think it's been, it's been very positive. As I mentioned again, I really enjoyed not only the experience in terms of kind of professional, development and the work, but also the community conversation that we held over these past couple of weeks. And I look forward to more. And yeah, again, it's been a pleasure.
And Iker, what's next for the exhibit? You have it running for a little bit longer, and then is there anything else planned?
Yeah, so it closes until November 28th, so there's plenty of time for people to travel to Columbus and see the installations. There are activities already happening this coming weekend. I know Exhibit Columbus and the organization is organizing a lot of community programs, and then we have two core weekends organized around October 2nd and October 23rd, where we will bring together some of the participants and also connect with other initiatives like the Chicago Architecture Biennial. So there will be those core activities, but plenty of time to enjoy and visit the installations.
Well, thank you both for joining us. It's been a pleasure to speak with you. Iker Gill is the co-curator of Exhibit Columbus, and Belinda Tato is an architect for Ecosistema Urbano. After a quick break, we'll be joined by experts to talk about the impact of climate change on Indiana and its industries. If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking about climate change's impact on the environment in Indiana. And with us is Jeff Dukes, professor of forestry, natural resources, and biological sciences at Purdue, and director of the Purdue Climate Change Research Center. Welcome, Jeff.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
We've seen a lot of severe weather events lately, from fires to tropical storms. Is Indiana and the Midwest spared so far from these types of extreme weather events?
We don't see as much in the way of wildfires as other parts of the country, and we don't see as much hurricane damage as the other parts of the country. So we're not in the news when it comes to changes in those types of events. We see here more things like tornadoes and flooding, and with those sorts of events, we certainly feel them when they hit. The flooding is pretty clearly linked in some cases to climate change. I mean, there were recent floods in Tennessee that were really big, and we can see that those sorts of things are linked to climate change. The tornadoes, it's a little less clear. But lately, all the news is about wildfires and hurricanes and in places of the country where they're seeing real clear climate change linked changes and decreases in people's quality of life. And, fortunately, in a way, that's not us.
Is there a reason why it's not hit the Midwest yet? I mean, I can imagine eventually some of that climate change impact would hit here.
Oh, yeah. I'm not saying that climate change hasn't hit the Midwest yet. I guess I'm just saying that we're not as affected by the wildfires and the hurricanes that are maybe in a way a little more clearly traceable to changes in climate than they're splashy and in the news. But we're definitely affected by climate change here, and it is affecting some of our extreme events like floods. you know, our climate has warmed already in Indiana, and it's also gotten quite a bit wetter in Indiana. The warming here hasn't been as dramatic as some other places. It's been 1.3 degrees over 125 or so years. The amount that we've gotten wetter is pretty impressive. We've gotten about 6.5 inches wetter on average across the state over the last 125 years. So that's 6.5 more inches of rain per year on average than we used to get. And more of our rain is coming in the heaviest downpours. So when we get a really heavy rain event now, it's likely to be substantially wetter, substantially heavier than it would have been, say, back before the 1950s or so. So we definitely are seeing changes. We've been spared a little bit on the worst of the warming. Many other parts of the country and the world have gotten a lot more warming than we have. We think in part that may be because our farmers have been doing a really good job of growing crops more densely on the landscape. And when crops, or any plant for that matter, evaporates water into the air, it basically cools the air around it. And so we've seen during the period of time when there's been a lot of warming, we've seen less warming here, probably at least in part, because the farmers have been growing more and more crops here during that time. But in any case, the point is, we are actually seeing some pretty dramatic changes in our climate right here already. It's just that our extreme events have more to do with things like floods that may come than to do with wildfires. It's possible that the climate change will bring us in a direction where we could start seeing more wildfires here, but we're a ways from that still.
Well, when you mentioned some warming, I think we've seen in the last few decades that there's a couple of degrees of warming happening, and maybe, I don't know, 2, 3 degrees, 4 degrees, something like that. Does that make a huge impact, or is that something that you would see long term having an effect?
So the warming that's happened so far is already having an impact in terms of it's making any given heat event that we get a little bit worse. And, you know, you don't know where the threshold is for things that you care about, for any given person, you know, having real heat related problems going into heat stroke or something. We don't know, you know, how many degrees on what day triggered that event happening exactly. Right. It's for any given person. It's hard to say. But we do know, you know, as we get warmer, all these events are getting worse. And so, yeah, I would say that the warming that we've had so far, you know, it does have an effect. It's not huge. The warming that we expect to happen in the future is much greater, and we expect the implications of that to be substantially worse than from what we've seen so far. And you know, in some parts of the country, like in the western U.S., the warming that's happened so far contributes to fuels drying out faster, which leads them to be more flammable and leads wildfires to spread faster and farther. And so, you know, that little bit of warming there leads to faster drying, which can make the wildfire season much worse, as we've seen. So the implications of the warming are different in different places. Here, we're not right on the cusp of having a really flammable vegetation. So it's, you know, that particular impact isn't as dramatic. But in terms of seeing potential reductions in crop growth, well, we're already there. Warmer climates are going to are likely to cause reductions in crop growth if we get warming during the growing season. Those, you know, those extreme hot days, as they get hotter, the crops don't like that. And it also puts more people at risk, and it makes air quality worse. We get ozone formation on the sort of clear, sunny, hot days when we have the right sort of soup of chemicals in the atmosphere. And not only are we putting more and more of those ingredients that form ozone into the atmosphere, but we're heating conditions up in the air. And so that makes all those reactions happen faster that produce ozone, which then goes into people's lungs and hurts their cardiovascular system and puts them at risk, particularly if they have asthma. So there's a whole range of things that get triggered by warmer conditions And so basically, you know, when warming happens, it is generally problematic in a variety of ways for health and for the growth of our crops in this region. We can adapt to some of these changes, but we need to be aware that they're happening.
Well, when you mentioned air quality, I was just thinking about a few weeks back looking at my weather app on my phone, and it was saying, you know, sensitive air quality is bad for sensitive folks. And I thought it was linked to the debris from the fires heading over this way. Is that part of it? Like, I guess what I'm wondering is the fires may not be directly hitting us here, but we're still going to suffer the effects of them.
Oh, yeah, sure. Absolutely. That plays into it. And sometimes the smoke may go over high enough so that it doesn't influence our air quality. Sometimes it may come through at lower altitudes and cause an effect. It's certainly affecting the air quality or the quality of air that people are breathing in California and in states to the west where those fires are happening. We may or may not get lucky. But in general, warming is gonna reduce our air quality, whether or not we're talking about getting that smoke. I mean, that smoke is one mechanism that can affect our through which climate change can affect our air quality. But just warming on its own will also reduce our air quality on those hottest days, as long as we're emitting the sorts of chemicals into the atmosphere that we are right now.
Do you think Indiana's prepared for weather events, extreme weather events from more rain or warming conditions?
No, not really. There are a bunch of challenges. I think one of the challenges that is hard for people to maybe internalize to sort of take into account is that we like to think about the climate where we are as being this sort of set thing. And we might plan our roads and our culverts and sort of how we structure our environment around us based on the climate that we've experienced in the past. And the statistics of that climate are what we can use to say, okay, well, this is what Indiana climate is like, for instance. But in reality, if our climate is not static, if it's not the climate of the past, then we have to be thinking a lot harder about, well, okay, what is the climate of the future? What do we expect the climate of the future to be? And if we're putting in a piece of infrastructure or designing a plan that's supposed to be in place for a decade or 3 decades or 5 decades, we've got to be planning for that piece of infrastructure, say, to be doing a good job 3 or 5 decades from now. And so I don't think we're taking into account in most cases that future climate when we're and just the fact that our climate today isn't even what it was 30 years ago when we are making decisions. You know, there are some people and agencies that are starting to do that, but I don't think it's widespread yet. And it really needs to be. It's something that we need to be moving on across the state so that we're not surprised by something we really shouldn't be surprised by.
If you have any questions or comments for our guest today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're going to bring in another guest into our conversation right now to talk about the impact of climate change on agriculture. With us is Lingxi Chenyang, Environmental Law Fellow at Indiana University's Environmental Resilience Institute. Lingxi, it's great to have you on again.
Thanks so much for having me.
With temperatures rising in recent years, what are some of the biggest ways climate change has impacted Indiana's agriculture?
Sure. So as a little bit of a background, agriculture is a huge part of Indiana's economy. Farmland takes up more than 60% of our land, and it contributes about an estimated $32 billion to our economy. So generally, climate change will create more extreme events on both ends. So, for example, in 2012, Indiana was struck by about the worst drought that we've seen in nearly 25 years. As a result, more than 90% of our corn and soybean acres were considered moisture deficient. And that drought caused about $30 billion in damages across the region. But then just 7 years later, 2019 was the worst planting season on record due to flooding. About 32 rivers flooded in the Midwest. And while the 2012 drought killed crops that were already in the ground, floods generally keep farmers from planting them in the first place. So part of the problem, I think, is that the vast majority of farmland in Indiana is devoted to two crops, corn and soybeans. And a lot of this is fed to livestock animals. That means that whenever something like a drought occurs, it has a huge impact on farmland generally. If emissions continue to rise, some predict that corn yield losses could be as high as about 70% by the end of the century. So climate change will have a big impact on crop yields.
Well, that's huge, 70%. What changes are farmers doing in order to adapt to climate changes?
Yeah. So some of the best practices that farmers are adopting are cover crops and reducing tillage on their soils. These practices can help protect crops against drought and flooding. They also help diversify yield. And my research has found that if farmers incorporate trees on land, crop-producing trees like nut trees and fruit trees, it can sequester a lot of carbon. So one study found that if farmers incorporated trees on just 10% of farmland in the U.S., that could offset carbon emissions from fossil fuels by 34%. So there are lots of things that farmers can do both to protect themselves from the impacts of climate change, but also contribute to reducing climate impacts over the long term.
And have you heard any concerns from Indiana farmers about climate change? Is this something that's on their radar?
Oh, for sure. So one of my colleagues at ERI, Matt Hauser, who's a sociologist, found that 44 out of 50 farmers that he interviewed believed in climate change. They believe that climate change is happening. Surprisingly, more farmers actually believe that climate change is happening than the general population in Indiana. This seems surprising, but, you know, farmers are actually at the front lines of climate changes. You know, we in the cities might experience more hotter days in summer, more rain, but weather changes really affect farmers' bottom line. Most farmers believe that climate change is happening.
Yeah, I can imagine they're seeing it firsthand. And Jeff, what are your thoughts on what's happening with agriculture in Indiana and climate change?
Well, I think it's a really interesting time. I go out and talk to farmers on a pretty regular basis, and they want to try to understand the changes that are happening, and they want to know what they can do about them. The ways that they're being affected here in Indiana, there are a variety of them, but one, over the longer term, the growing season's getting longer. And that might affect what they can plant, or in southern Indiana, it might affect whether they can plant, say, two crops in a season. That may eventually be possible. They understand increasingly that as Lingxi said, that cover crops can help combat some of the problems that they're seeing. And those problems include the substantially wetter conditions that we're getting, and those are particularly problematic in the spring. Unfortunately, our climate projections from the Indiana Climate Change Impact Assessment suggest that we're going to have much wetter springs and winters. And getting more water in this winter and spring is just not useful for crops and agriculture. It's, of course, not useful for cities downstream either if they're going to be flooding more often. But for farmers, having those wet springs, as Lingxi mentioned, like in 2019, that's a real problem because they can't get into the field to plant. And that may affect what they can plant even. It effectively shortens their growing season. So even if there are warmer conditions that should allow them to grow things for longer, if they can't get seeds in the ground, then that's a problem for them. So the additional water can be a problem in terms of shortening their effective growing season. It can be a problem when that water's coming down harder, you know, in these heavier rainfall events that I talked about earlier, because that can lead to more soil erosion, which they can combat by using cover crops. But there is an upfront cost to them of planting these cover crops that they don't actually sell. And then the extreme heat that we're getting is also challenging because that's just not good for plant growth. That can reduce yield and does reduce yields. So there's a bunch of these challenges that they face. And while cover crops are one solution, and hopefully better varieties that are adapted to warmer conditions can be another solution. Also thinking more outside the box, I think, is going to be increasingly useful going forward.
I wonder if looking at the environment as it changes and planting things to go with what, like, for example, if we're becoming more tropical, planting tropical things. I don't know. I don't know much about plants, but I'm just wondering if that's going to be part of the shift.
I think in general, the shift is going to be more subtle than that. It may be adding in a different crop to the rotation or another crop to the rotation. Or, you know, we may have some sorts of perennial crops that come in that could be, that get bred, that could be very, very useful, that are maybe things we don't see on the landscape right now. Or things that there could be things that come to us from warmer climates, but it's not going to be such a stark change in climate that we're going to be growing, you know, bananas in Indiana or something like that. We're still going to have winters. There's still going to be some really good cold stretches, just maybe not quite as cold in the past. So that you won't see the shift probably super dramatically across the landscape, but there will be adjustments that come.
All right, well, we'll be back after a quick break. We're talking with experts about climate change in Indiana. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All in Vox Pop. Just search for All in Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send us your question or comment, and we'll try to get it onto the show. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're discussing the impact of climate change on Indiana and its industries. With us are Jeff Dukes, professor of forestry, natural resources, and biological sciences at Purdue and director of the Purdue Climate Change Research Center, and Lingxi Chenyang, environmental law fellow at Indiana University's Environmental Resilience Institute. Lingxi, you study a lot of laws and policies around agriculture in the country. Do we have laws in Indiana to help farmers, for example, when there are extreme weather events?
Yeah, so I think farmers generally are influenced the most, at least financially, by federal policies. So these come in the form of crop insurance and various farm payment programs, which help farmers bounce back financially after a tough year. Those policies tend to support cropping practices that are not resilient, like monoculture, corn and soy cropping practices. I think at the state level laws generally have more influence over water management. So there was a bill that was passed this year, SB 389, that drastically reduces wetland protection in the state. So about 80% of wetlands in Indiana are state protected and 20% are federally protected. And the bill undid a lot of the protections for that 80%. And, you know, wetlands are, they serve a number of important environmental functions. So this bill was not great in terms of climate change because wetlands, scientists have found, are very carbon dense. They store carbon in the plants and soil, about 7 times more carbon than farmland soils. And so when you drain a wetland, those plants decompose and release carbon into the atmosphere. That bill is also not great for clean drinking water. Wetlands are connected to groundwater stores that we rely on for drinking water, and wetland plants help filter pollutants before they enter into those groundwater sources. And that bill is also not great for biodiversity. So wetlands serves important breeding grounds for many bird and animal species that matter a lot to, you know, our nature lovers and hunters. So that was a state level law that was passed that undid a lot of wetland protections.
And, you know, obviously that sounds like it's going to have an impact further down the line. Jeff, are you predicting that this will have a harmful effect?
Well, yeah, unfortunately. One of the challenges, as I mentioned before, with climate change as we are experiencing it and expecting it to accelerate in Indiana, is this increase in precipitation in the winter and spring, and the heaviest rainfall events becoming heavier year round. And so another thing that wetlands do that's very helpful is they slow down the runoff of water into our ditches and creeks and rivers, and so they also allow more of that water to get absorbed into the land. And so if we're expecting to have heavier rainfall, the wetlands become all the more important for buffering our creeks and streams and rivers against flooding. And so having less wetland on the landscape means that we're likely to see those rivers rise faster and have more flooding challenges.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to Indiana not being prepared, Lingxi, does Indiana have any compare, I guess if you compare Indiana to other states and what they're doing for climate change, where do we stack up here?
So I think generally Indiana is a little bit behind on climate change policies compared to our neighbors. So as an example, Illinois, Michigan, and Kentucky have all released statewide climate recommendations or plans in the last 15 years. Indiana hasn't passed any climate-related legislation, although, you know, our cities, communities, and schools are picking up the slack. So about 15 cities, including where I live in Indianapolis, have some sort of climate action plan in place to reduce their carbon footprint and to deal with this hotter, wetter weather that we're going to see. On the other hand, there was a bill that was introduced this year that didn't make it through Congress, the state Congress, that would have been really helpful for our farmers. Basically asked the Department of Natural Resources to help farmers and forest land owners get money for storing carbon on their land. So as I mentioned, farmers can do this by planting fruit and nut trees and sometimes cover crops. And the way that the bill would do this is that, you know, major corporations like Apple want to become carbon neutral. And so they basically pledge to offset a certain amount of carbon they can't cut from their own facilities by paying landowners elsewhere to reduce their carbon emissions. So that bill, if it had become law, would have helped farmers tap into this very lucrative carbon market. And that would have been really helpful, I think, for our smaller farmers whose bottom line is going to be hurt by, you know, these droughts and floods. So it's my hope that this bill gets reintroduced in the next session and gets passed.
Well, we have a listener voicemail from Lynn who has a comment about woods and large trees in Indiana. Let's take a listen.
This is Lynn Belena, and I live in the Yorktown general area. And I've seen a lot more wood being cut. I've lived in Indiana all my life, and everywhere I drive, there are woods that aren't there anymore. So I really think that we need to find a way to stop that if we're going to help with that. I agree with their variation in crop, which is one of my things I was wanting to say, and certainly I think we need to do that. So mainly I was concerned about the loss of our woods and our large trees. Thank you.
Jeff, so are we seeing a loss of trees throughout the state?
Well, we're seeing turnover in forest for sure. I'm not sure that we're seeing a big loss of woods on the whole if you look across everything. And there's one of the challenges is that there's value to lots of different types of habitats. So there's, in some cases, if you cut down a forest and allow it to regenerate, you'll have habitat that's really useful for some species that can't live in an older forest. But there's also a lot of value in having the old growth forest around, and a lot of people would like to see more of that. So I think the challenge for climate change is to look at this sort of holistically. Do you have enough different types of forest that are and different ages of forests that are providing habitat for the different species that you want to be supporting? And also, are you maintaining and increasing your overall carbon stock? Because the atmosphere doesn't really care about how much carbon is stored on any given patch of land. It cares how much carbon is stored on land in total around the globe and how much we're emitting, how much carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases we're emitting into it. So if we look as a state of Indiana, if we look across all our forests, what's going to be important is, you know, how much carbon total is stored in trees and in soils. And the program that would have been proposed or would have been put in place would have provided through this bill that Ling-Xi was talking about, that would have set up a market that would have allowed Indiana farmers and forest landholders to sort of sell into that, sell carbon offsets, carbon credits, into that market, to basically match them with different corporations more easily. There still may be something that happens next year, or this could happen on a national scale. There's a working group right now that the state has in place that the State Department of Agriculture and the Department of Natural Resources are organizing to look more in depth at this issue, at how they would go about implementing something like this. So it's certainly not completely off the table yet, and this could get put in place in a variety of ways. But it is tricky. There are a lot of little issues to work out, and you want to be careful when you do something like that you're not essentially incentivizing, say, forest to be cut somewhere else when you're trying to incentivize carbon to be stored in a, in one certain place on the landscape.
Well, Lingxi, when it comes to the carbon storage, I want to go back to that because I'm just trying to understand how would a farmer take part in a program where they're getting paid to store carbon?
Sure. So the farmer, you know, a given farmer can dedicate part of the land to planting nut trees or fruit trees, and they would essentially sign a contract where they would be obligated to keep and manage those trees on their land and sell those credits to, you know, a given corporation that wants to buy those offsets. And to maintain the permanence of the carbon, to make sure that the carbon doesn't get released, that contract ensures that the farmer doesn't cut down those trees.
Mm. Well, couldn't a company also just plant a lot of trees around whatever new place they're building to help out with that, or put like a rooftop garden?
Yeah, definitely. So corporations can create their own offsets, and they can also pay landowners elsewhere to sequester carbon on their land. And I think the reason that corporations want to do the second thing is because, you know, farmland just takes up so much land in the U.S. It's about 50% of the U.S. that's dedicated to farmland. So that's a lot of farmland that could be used to sequester carbon instead of producing fields and fields of crops that don't actually get fed to humans.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of crops not getting fed to humans, it makes me think of just the livestock and whether that's contributing to a lot of the problems we're seeing with methane and stuff. Jeff, is that a huge issue? Like, if we didn't have as much livestock, would that help our environment?
Well, yeah, I mean, it would. I think there's no getting around that. And there's a couple reasons. One is that the livestock, they can't help it when they're digesting stuff. They produce methane, so they'll eat they'll graze or eat feed, whatever they eat. They essentially end up producing methane in their stomachs, and they end up burping up most of it into the atmosphere. And it, you know, there are little tweaks that you can do to try to reduce that a bit. You can feed them certain seaweeds, and that can reduce some of the methane emissions. But you can't easily sprinkle seaweed out across the landscape when they're grazing, for instance, which is what they're doing for most of their life in many cases. And so there's challenges in figuring out sort of how do we implement these technologies that are just now emerging that might help us to combat that. The other way that livestock are contributing to climate change in a pretty big way is that many parts of the world, less so in this country, but in many parts of the world, there is still forest being converted to rangeland, forests being cut down so that ranchers can graze their cattle over larger areas. And when those forests are cut down, of course, all the carbon that's stored in those trees goes back up to the atmosphere. Often the forests are burned, but one way or another, when the forest is turned into a rangeland, the carbon in the trees decomposes and starts contributing to climate change because less of it's stored on land. So you know, livestock, it's I think in any given place, someone may have a livestock operation and may be doing everything that they can. They may to minimize the impact of it, including things like managing the effluent from the livestock operations, and because there's another source of methane and nitrous oxide emission potentially that's heating the planet. But if you look at it globally, it's really hard to manage this. There's this global demand. As we have greater and greater demand, essentially more and more forest gets cut down, and the more head of livestock you have around the world, the more methane is being produced. So it is a real challenge, and it does in the end come back to global meat consumption and sort of trends in personal preferences on that front.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about energy before we wrap up in a couple of moments. We have a question from Dean on Twitter who asks, are there any state or federal tax incentives for adding solar panels to your house, Lingxi?
I'm not sure what the answer to that question is. I have to dig it up a little bit. I do know that many churches have, I think, voluntarily put up solar panels on their rooftops. About 50 churches around the state have done so. So I think a lot of homeowners and institutions are voluntarily doing these things, partly to save energy, but partly I think to show that climate change is really happening and to show that there's something that every one of us can do something about.
Mm-hmm. And are there policies towards solar energy at all that you're seeing?
I don't think anything was introduced this past year. And there might be something at the federal level, but I think not so much at the state level.
Jeff, what about your thoughts on the energy industry and climate change?
Yeah, I'd say if anything in the state, we've kind of been going the opposite direction in terms of policy. We've been the incentives for putting solar on houses and things have been getting phased out at an accelerating rate in recent years. And so so relative to other states, we have pretty few incentives for solar. There is a sort of a task force in the legislature that's looking at these issues right now and trying to figure out what our future energy mix should be and how we can put it on whatever the right course that they decide is. It's not totally clear what they're going to recommend and where that's going to go in the future. The one really encouraging thing, or I, not just the one, but one of the really encouraging trends over the last decade plus is the rate at which the cost of solar energy and wind energy have been plummeting. It is so much cheaper now to install solar and wind than it used to be and to operate those. So now pretty much everywhere it's going to be cheaper to, well, not everywhere, but in many, many places, it's going to be cheaper to install a new solar plant and operate it, or a new wind operation and operate it, than it is going to be to run existing coal-fired power plants. You don't have to buy any fuel for solar plants or for wind farms. You can just let that natural energy flow, essentially. And so so it's now cost competitive to shift from coal to solar or shift from coal to wind. There are just challenges with the fact that the sun isn't always shining and the wind isn't always blowing. But the good news on that front is that battery costs are coming down too. We can put out now industrial scale batteries much, much more cheaply than we used to be able to. And so that helps somewhat with this challenge of intermittent or variable power coming from renewables. And as we increasingly upgrade our transmission infrastructure so that we can send energy from one place to another where this wind is blowing to where it's not, for instance, around the country, that's going to help a lot as well. So there are a lot of really promising changes happening on this front. We're seeing in northern Indiana really rapid rollouts of solar and wind by NIPSCO, company that's responsible for a lot of the energy customers in the northern part of the state. And I think, it's pretty likely that going forward, we're going to see investments and policies that increasingly incentivize this, increasingly help us decarbonize our energy infrastructure and our energy supply. And that's going to go, a good chunk of the way towards helping with climate change. There's lots and lots of other things that we need to do too, but the energy industry is a huge player in this.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both for taking the time to join us this afternoon. Jeff Dukes is a professor of forestry, natural resources, and biological sciences at Purdue University and the director of the Purdue Climate Change Research Center. And Lingxi Chenyang is an environmental law fellow at Indiana University's Environmental Resilience Institute. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.